Hey there, this is Virginia Prescott with producer Sarah Plourd.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
We're having a secret drive.
Got it. If you love the show, consider making a small donation to the station where we make it, and we will send you some secret swag.
What is it?
I can't tell. It's a secret.
All right. Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in to get yours.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope that you will make some noise for word of mouth.
The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier this spring, brush fires sent plumes of smoke over the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey. That's right, a forest fire in New Jersey. We do hear of wildfires spreading across the West, like the massive blaze in Fort McMurray, Canada, but a combination of factors, including climate change, may be threatening other parts of the country.
The single most destructive fire in U.S. history could occur not in the American West, but in the Northeast. In the New Jersey Pinelands, a 1.1 million acre tract, a small wildfire breaks out every few days this spring.
Kyle Dickman is contributing editor at Outside Magazine. He wrote for Rolling Stone about the possibility of America's worst wildfire disaster happening on the populated East Coast. We reached him on Skype. Kyle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard a little bit from a video that accompanied your article, which takes us into the heavily forested Pinelands in southern New Jersey. And someone there you spoke to called the Pinelands the biotic equivalent of a munitions depot. What is the Pinelands and why is it especially at risk for wildfire disaster?
So the Pinelands is a 1.1 million acre tract of forested land that's just outside, it's actually between Philadelphia and Atlantic City. Why is it so at risk for wildfires? It's because since it was set aside as a reserve in the 1970s, there's been very little management done to that land. And so that's just given the forest an opportunity to grow much, much thicker. And I think what people forget about New Jersey is that it used to be all forest and it used to burn regularly. And so now you have this tract of forest that's surrounded by 750,000 people, and the ecology of that environment hasn't changed.
So there are regular little brush fires inside of this forest land. Have there been many this year?
There haven't been many this year. They do get regular wildfires every year. Most of them are actually started by people. The thing is that their forest fire service is really good at catching them before they get big and destructive. And the reason that is because most of the fires have to have a certain alignment of conditions to get big and explosive. It has to be dry, it has to be windy, and they just haven't had those conditions when a fire started this year.
There was, however, a large wildfire in the Pinelands in 1963, but in your reporting, you found that the same fire would be much more destructive today. Why?
Mostly because there's a lot more people. And so if you look at wildfires in the West, which is where I'm from, what drives costs out here is mostly just the number of houses that a fire burns or the number of houses that it threatens to burn. So in New Jersey, there are now 500,000 more people living in the same place that this fire burned in 1963. And so if that fire were to occur today, it would be exponentially more destructive.
Well, Kyle, you have seen wildfire disasters up close. You live in Santa Fe. You worked as a firefighter, worked as a hotshot. So do you think you are more disposed, you know, to see the vulnerability, to think that the big one is coming?
Because I was a hotshot, I don't think so. I think mostly because I've spent a lot of time talking to experts in this field. I mean, I would make the case that my personal experience as a firefighter taught me how to swing at Pulaski, but not judge whether or not a town was liable to burn. But the way I came on this story is I talked to a guy, he's the foremost fire expert in the world, named Stephen Pine. And Stephen Pine said, sort of in passing, he said, the worst wildfire in American history is likely to hit New Jersey. And that was when my ears sort of perked up and I was like, what? New Jersey has forests?
Well, we did see during Superstorm Sandy, of course, what happens when disaster strikes a dense urban area. Is there capacity there in this least populated parts of the state to fight a large-scale fire?
I would probably make the case that there's not capacity anywhere to fight a fire like 1963. It's very difficult to control a wildfire when it's burning with a strong wind blowing it. I mean, even in the West, where we have 30,000 wildfires every year, there are still wildfires that we just can't stop because they're burning too intensely. And again, what makes it so scary in New Jersey is that rule applies there. There's just more people.
Yeah, like a 500 million people in population is the guess in the greater, let's say, metropolitan area of New York, which could potentially feel some effects?
Absolutely, they could. Mostly what they would see, they'd be sucking smoke. I mean, so all that forest burns, and even small wildfires will blow smoke into New York City. And I just think it's an apocalyptic image of standing in Manhattan and looking up, you know, seeing a smoke column rising from the Pinelands. But that's happened, and it absolutely will happen again.
In proposing that this could be the most destructive fire in history, how do you actually measure a fire's destruction?
Money spent is the number one metric. I think the most important metric is lives lost. You know, hopefully we wouldn't see any lives lost, but I don't know. If history is any lesson, there probably will be. It would be just way too chaotic. But yeah, it's mostly lives lost and money spent.
I'm talking with Kyle Dickman, who reported for Rolling Stone about where the single most destructive wildfire could happen in the U.S., and it's not out west, but on the densely populated East Coast. Well, in your article, we do get a number of points of view on this. Many say, you know, it's not if, but when this is going to hit. But yet an analytics firm says they're not even studying it. Is there agreement that the Pinelands are indeed a dangerous fire risk?
Is there consensus that a wildfire is imminent in New Jersey? There is amongst most experts that I spoke with. So I think there's a little bit of resistance among the state foresters. When I spoke to them, they were pretty insistent that they felt they had a handle on this. But they were the only ones who felt they had a handle on it. All the other experts I spoke to said, you can't control a wildfire, and it's just a matter of time before the right conditions align and you have something destructive crop up. But the question is, how destructive will it be?
So what is being done to prepare the Pinelands for a fire of that scale?
I guess I would say not very much. That's the truth. And it's a little bit hard to blame them. I mean, in the West, there's this quote from one of the researchers in New Jersey, and he says, in California, every year you escape a fire, somebody else's house burns. And in New Jersey, you can go 25 years without seeing any houses burn. So it's a hard thing to keep that risk on the forefront of everybody's conscience, because why would you be worried about something that only happens once a generation? Mm. There are things that can be done. You have to thin the forest. You have to manage it more proactively, things like prescribed fire. So reintroducing natural or intentionally set fires to mimic natural fires and thin out the forest, so when a fire does come through, it burns less intensely. Each homeowner can create what's called defensible space or create a clearing about 100 feet away from their house, limb up the trees, make sure you don't have brush growing right next to your home. So there are lots of things that can be done, but again, it's hard to do that stuff if you're just not thinking about wildfires.
Yeah, I think so many people in urban areas are concerned with quote-unquote urban problems. Urban areas are where the most damage in terms of lives lost and buildings and infrastructure lost could happen. What do you think will make city dwellers start to think about this kind of thing?
Well, people talk about Denver burning. You just need a big incident where you see the type of chaos that a wildfire could wreak on a city. And so in 1990, there was a fire in downtown Oakland that killed 25 people, destroyed 3,300 homes and 2,000 vehicles. It cost $2.67 billion to pick up that damage. And that's, you know, that's pretty extreme, and nobody is hoping any of that will happen. But I think for city dwellers to realize that if they live next to the wilderness, or if they live next to an urban area like San Diego or Los Angeles or Deptford, New Jersey, that they have to be ready for that landscape to ignite, because that's a natural thing and it's going to happen.
Well, we are far from New Jersey and all of those, you know, chemical plants and industry on the side of the parkway. Here in New Hampshire, what are the chances that forest fires could be more common here?
I don't know about more common, but small, even small patches of wildlands can burn. And so it doesn't have to be a big fire to be a destructive fire. And there are a lot of stories from old firefighters from the Northeast about really big, bad, destructive blazes hitting that part of the country. And I think, like I said, it doesn't have to be big to be destructive. And I think that's what people should be aware of.
Kyle Dickman, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kyle Dickman, he's an author and contributing editor at Outside Magazine. You find a link to more on his article for Rolling Stone, which has maps and historical details and a really interesting little video. The article is called "Will America's Worst Wildfire Disaster Happen in New Jersey?" And the link, again, at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked about the threat of wildfire in the Pinelands of New Jersey, which could spread to forests throughout the Northeast. It is a scary prospect because no matter what we do to prevent wildfire disasters, weather largely determines where and when the next big fire will strike and end. That is one reason, as producer Stephen Jackson reports, that people have been trying to control the weather for a very long time.
For as long as humans have been around, we've been at the mercy of the weather. And for as long as that's been the case, we've wanted a way out, a way to control the weather to suit our needs. In the distant past, we used sacrifices, rain dances. Today, we turn to science, which is where cloud seeding comes in. It's humanity's latest attempt to do what has always seemed impossible, to harness the clouds and make them rain. Let's begin in Fargo, North Dakota, at the headquarters of Weather Modification Incorporated, or WMI. It's the largest cloud seeding company in the world.
I like to say that we're the Microsoft or the Starbucks of the weather modification world because we've got like 14 full-time personnel. So,
Hans Allness is the vice president of operations. We take a walk through the Bravo hangar. It's an ice cream white warehouse about the size of a football field.
So here's another kind of airplane. This is a piston twin. This one will be in California this winter, making snow.
WMI seeds clouds for water districts, public utilities, hydroelectric power companies, any organization that wants more precipitation.
Yeah. What they're trying to do is make more snow that in the spring melts and fills dams for hydroelectric power, and eventually in California, water gets used about 3 times. So it'll be hydroelectric power, it'll be irrigation, municipal water. So maybe eventually it'll get to the ocean.
In a couple weeks, WMI will send its fleet of planes to Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada, and California. Once they get there, they'll fly into frigid winter clouds, spraying a mist of chemicals, hoping to trigger snow. And when it gets warmer, they'll fly somewhere else and make rain instead. We'll get to how cloud seeding works in a little bit. First, some history. Over the years, people have tried all kinds of crazy ideas to squeeze more water out of the sky.
There's a lot of colorful people, let's put it that way.
Jim Fleming is a professor of science, technology, and society at Colby College. He says one of the first big rainmaking projects in America was proposed in the 1830s by a meteorologist named James Espy. Espy thought he could increase precipitation by sending hot air into the atmosphere, which would then cool and fall as rain. His big idea was to set fire to the Appalachian Mountains every weekend.
And by Monday morning, the air would be fresh and the rivers would be full, recharged with water, and the fields would be watered as well. And people thought he was really crazy.
But Espy was completely sane compared to General Robert Dyrenforth, who got into the rainmaking game in the 1890s. He wasn't a real general, by the way. He just called himself one. And Dyrenforth thought that explosions shook the clouds and caused rain. And so, with federal funding, he put together a huge arsenal of explosives and headed to Texas.
And proceeded to try to make it rain by shooting off fireworks, floating balloons that were filled with hydrogen, and blowing them up in the sky. And it was very entertaining for the locals.
But it didn't work, like, at all. Fast forward about half a century to 1947 at the General Electric Corporation Research Lab. That year, three scientists were working on making artificial clouds: Irving Langmuir, Vincent Schaefer, and Bernard Vonnegut. And here's a fun fact. Bernard was Kurt Vonnegut's brother. Some of Kurt's sci-fi novels were inspired by Bernie's work. Anyway.
These three, Langmuir, Schaefer, and Vonnegut, are kind of known as the triumvirate of the early days of cloud seeding.
One day, the triumvirate was working in the lab, making little clouds in a freezer box. Schaefer took some dry ice, the same stuff people use to make fog in a haunted house, and scraped it into a cloud they just made, where it blossomed into millions of tiny ice particles. Snow.
And he says, aha, I think I've got something here. And so he went out with a rented airplane over the Berkshires, and they sprinkled some dry ice over a cloud, and they made a little snowstorm.
We put about 6 pounds of dry ice into this 4-mile cloud, and within a very few minutes, saw long streamers of snow falling from the base of the cloud and evaporating into the drier air below.
Here's how it works. Clouds are full of water, but they won't precipitate unless there's an impurity in the cloud, some little fleck for the water molecules to glom onto, like soot or mineral dust, or in this case, dry ice. Once that impurity enters the picture, it becomes the nucleus of an ice crystal, and that crystal attracts water molecules and gets heavier and heavier until it falls as snow or hail or melts into rain on its way down to Earth. So while Schaefer seeded that first cloud over the Berkshires, Irving Langmuir, the lead researcher on the team, watched from the airport below.
And immediately he was on the phone before the plane even landed to the New York Times with the storyline that man can control the weather. And this was the next day's headline.
For the first time in all history, there is now open to man the possibility of exerting some control over the weather. Probably the most remarkable achievement of the year.
The very same year, Bernard Vonnegut discovered a chemical that worked even better than dry ice. It was called silver iodide, and it mimicked the structure of a natural ice crystal, making it the perfect particle to attract water molecules and jumpstart precipitation. Most cloud seeding operations still use silver iodide today. Back in Fargo, WMI seeds clouds all over the world, from India to Canada to Saudi Arabia. They get lots of business, but there's also plenty of critics, and they fall into three camps. First, there's the folks who worry about the environmental repercussions. And it's true, seeding sounds pretty scary, pumping clouds full of silver iodide. But so far, studies haven't found a negative effect on the environment.
I mean, you could eat it on your Wheaties, except it tastes horrible, so I wouldn't recommend it.
You tasted it?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, not, you know, just mixing chemical and stuff, and you get it on your hands, and you get a little mouthful of it. And yeah, it's not really a very good tasting.
Group number two is the conspiracy theorists, people who think cloud seeding is part of a worldwide government plot, like chemtrails or fluoride in the water. Allness gets a lot of angry phone calls.
They think we have some sort of godlike powers where we can just move clouds around at will and make it drought, you know, whatever fickle mood we're in that day.
A while back, he had to notify the police when someone called the office over and over again, threatening his employees by name. The third group is scientists. There's a lot of doubt among some scientists about how effective cloud seeding even is.
No cloud is the same as another cloud, and no cloud will ever be the same as another cloud.
Rulof Brientes researches cloud seeding at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He says every cloud is a unique and chaotic swirl of variables, so it's hard to prove that a seeded cloud wouldn't have rained or snowed anyway if it had been left alone. And it's pretty much impossible to replicate results. But thanks to improved technology like satellites and computer models, Brientes says they're learning more every day.
And I think especially during the past 20 years, our understanding has increased tremendously.
The state of Wyoming recently finished a 9-year study on cloud seeding in the mountains. And the data suggests that seeded clouds snow up to 15% more than unseeded clouds. But the conditions have to be perfect, with the right wind direction, the right amount of moisture, the right temperature.
So there's no one experiment you can do in one area that will be transferable to other areas all around the world.
The bottom line is, cloud seeding seems to work in some conditions, but it's not an exact science. Well, farmers and water managers and municipalities, they don't need an exact science. They need water.
They say if it works half the time, or maybe 10% of the time, it is still worthwhile for me to execute this, because water problems globally are going to increase in the next several decades, and many people will live under severe water stresses. So we are looking at all the tools to enhance these supplies and to sustain the supplies that we have.
Brientes says cloud seeding is not the answer to water scarcity. It's more like a long-term strategy to shore up local water supplies just a little bit. Hans Allness from WMI agrees.
It's just another tool to improve our lot in life and do it in an environmentally responsible manner, I guess.
Even though we've come a long way since ESPY and Dyrenforth, we're still pretty much at the mercy of the weather.
You have to work with what nature gives you, and that's the whole name of the game, is you're just working with what nature gives you.
We can't make clouds out of thin air, or orchestrate rainfall, or engineer our way out of a drought. Any real lasting solution to water scarcity has to start with conservation, with major changes in the way we use water, in industry and agriculture, and daily life. It's a tall order. But hey, if we can make it rain, we can do anything. Right? I'm Stephen Jackson.
And that piece was part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is spring, warming up to summer, the high holidays for wedding planners. Right now, the engaged are all in, finalizing menus, seating arrangements, and centerpieces. But what happens when someone decides not to go through with it? All those invitations out, those deposits paid, all those guests booked.
What's he doing?
Take care of him.
He's too late.
Well, we know how abruptly that wedding ended. Elaine ran off for an uncertain future with Benjamin in the Mike Nichols film The Graduate. Contemporary couples are seeking less dramatic ways to tell their guests or even recoup some money by selling their canceled wedding packages to other couples. The Brooklyn-based novelist, columnist, and screenwriter Amy Sohn wrote for the New York Times Style section about how some couples are dealing with calling it quits before getting hitched. And Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So you talked with a few women who decided to cancel their weddings in the works. How did they talk about that decision with you?
Well, they all said that it was a very emotionally fraught decision, in part because the financial stakes were so high. I think that the ethical stakes have always been high in the sense that there's a certain amount of shame and social impropriety involved. But I call it the wedding industrial complex. Makes these things really, really complicated, because how can you separate what your heart wants from all of those non-refundable deposits?
How many of these planned weddings don't come off?
Well, one study, which was a relatively small sample size of only about 1,200 couples, came up with a figure of 13% a year, which is about 250,000 weddings every year. Of course, it's hard to know. Could be much higher than that, because many couples get engaged and don't talk about it. You know, how do you judge what qualifies as an engagement? Mm-hmm. But assuming that it's about 250,000, that's a lot of cancellation.
Well, the planning of weddings has become even more public. I know from Facebook, you know, I see where people are talking about the honeymoons they've planned, or even posted samples of bands that they've booked for the wedding. Do you think it's even more mortifying to cancel a wedding than it was in the past when it was kind of secret?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the social media aspect of weddings, to the point where you can hire a social media consultant for your wedding at, you know, $2,000 to $5,000 additional costs, in addition to your band and your DJ and all the other things you're using, it means that these weddings are playing out in a very public way, beginning well before the actual event. There are not only save the date, you know, invitations that go out 6 or 8 months in advance of the wedding invitations, but you have engagement announcement videos where a camera is hidden as the question is popped. And then a lot of couples create videos of this, which they then send out as a way of announcing that they've gotten engaged, then chronicling every single step of wedding planning on social media, going to buy the dress, meeting the planner, picking out the floral. I mean, personally, to me, this would be like someone sharing with me like a dental hygiene diary. It's a part of the planning, which is to share it with everyone. And so what happens if a couple of months before the wedding, you suddenly decide that you don't want to do it, or worse, even far more humiliating, your spouse decides they don't want to marry you.
Mm.
And how do you chronicle that on social media? You have to change your status. Suddenly the photos, the wedding dress fittings become, you know, photos of the whiskey at the bottom of your glass as you're contemplating this very different future. So I think that the humiliation factor is greatly magnified by social media. And of course, there's a simple solution to this, which is that if you're less public about the planning, maybe it will be a little bit less humiliating if you cancel. But I don't think we're living in an age where that's an option.
Well, besides the image management, there's all this money. I mean, venues and photographers and videographers and wedding planners, they all get deposits. Are they used to this? Is that why they demand deposits?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of them, to be fair, are essentially small businesses, and the way they operate is on a calendar. And so once they book the day, they can't make money on that day if you cancel, say, you know, 7 or 8 weeks in advance, unless they can find someone else to fill the spot. But I do think it's a bit of a racket. I think there should be a better way where if they're able to recoup, in other words, if the vendor is able to find another couple, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a wedding couple, another event, and recoup the money, then they should refund the deposits. But unfortunately, that's not really how it works. The vendors control everything. The contracts are very strict, and there are vendors who will take the couples to court if the couple tries to get out of it. So it can get very, very ugly. And what's funny is that the big number seems to be the 90-day mark. You have a better chance of recouping a good percentage of your money if you cancel 91 days before.
Not to throw a wet blanket on wedding season, but we're talking with Amy Sohn, who's a screenwriter, novelist, and contributor to the New York Times Style section, who wrote about the aftermath of canceling a wedding, not just the social obligations, but how expensive it is. Well, I learned a lot of things reading this article, not the least of which was that wedding insurance is available. They do it for, you know, weather or military deployments or unexpected things. But now people can sell their abandoned wedding plans or packages to others. How does that work?
Yeah, there's a couple of sites that I found. One of them is called canceledweddings.com. I think this is actually the future, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Basically, you can sell your canceled event to another couple at an extremely discounted rate. And then the website, which serves as a kind of broker, takes a percentage. So we're already seeing this going on in the world of, you know, say if you have to cancel a hotel room or a plane reservation, why not let someone else take advantage of that? Why lose all the money just because your plans change? So I think that this is a really positive thing because it can be a bargain for other couples. The big question when it comes to weddings, as opposed to just a canceled hotel room, is do they feel that the date and the venue are cursed? And do they want to carry the emotional baggage of someone else's cancellation into their own wedding? Or are young couples sophisticated enough that they realize, hey, that's not my business, it's not my problem. If I can get 50% off, why not?
Well, you've also written about some kind of creative ways that brides or grooms, mostly brides, I think I've noticed, have kind of recouped their day. They've sort of rescued it from the dustbin by doing something else.
Yes, there are families that hold charity events. They do lunches for homeless children or families in need. There was a bride in Manhattan just this month who I guess they could not work out the details of their prenuptial agreement. And so I don't know whether she canceled or he canceled, but it was decided that they would not get married. She was getting married at an event space on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and there was an $8,000 non-refundable deposit. And the bride decided to throw kind of an early Mother's Day celebration for underprivileged children and their mothers. And I think that is an amazing example of making lemonade out of lemons. Why throw the money away? At least let someone have fun that day if it's not going to be you. And what's wonderful about this story is that the bride attended. In some of these cases, the jilted party did not attend the event. The parents, you know, did some sort of charity event or that kind of thing. But the jilted party was in too much pain to be able to go.
No.
So I think that that's an extremely individualistic decision, whether you're able to kind of brush yourself off and attend your canceled wedding or just let your family and some other people enjoy it. But I think the real problem is that the marketplace is set up to be extremely strict. And I think that if you could plan a wedding and do everything involved in it and just not call it a wedding, you could probably save 50% right off the bat. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you just hired a DJ and you tell them it's a party, they're going to quote you a rate significantly lower than if you tell them it's a wedding, even if the time commitment and everything else is exactly the same.
Well, Amy, you are a screenwriter, and there are some real stories of redemption in those that you write about here. Do I smell movie here? Is this a plot in the works?
Oh, well, didn't we already have a Runaway Bride with Julia Roberts?
That yeah, was a but we didn't have the, you know, then she has a charity party with her deposit.
That's true. Yeah, I actually, the pop culture one that I liked the most was they had a wedding that was canceled on the show Transparent in the middle of the wedding. In other words, one of the two brides realized her regret at the actual reception, which is a pretty amazing story. I mean, not 6 months down the line, not a year down the line, but at her own party. And then she had a panic attack in the bathroom and was able to get a kind of annulment. But thanks for giving me that tip. I got to call my agent in Hollywood and maybe get out there and start pitching.
All right. I just require a small percentage. But thank you, Amy, so much for speaking
with us. Is it refundable?
Amy, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Great. My pleasure.
Amy Soane, she's a Brooklyn-based novelist, columnist, and screenwriter. She's also a contributor to the New York Times Style section. And you really should take a look at her article, not just for the details, but also the fantastic illustration that one of the New York Times illustrators have come up with some samples of the kind of cards you'd send out if you canceled the wedding. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for The Bookshelf, the podcast where Peter Biello, NHPR's All Things Considered host, sits down with authors from the region.
Plymouth author Matthew Cheney's debut collection of stories, Blood, contains some of the most disturbing fiction I've read in a long time. Picture a future in which people sell their bodies to companies that can harvest renewable energy from them, or a past where vulnerable men are severely beaten for the amusement of others. Imagine if you could hear the dead speaking through an old record player. These scenarios make up just some of the worlds created with vivid and creepy detail in Cheney's fiction, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
And I should mention that this collection won the Hudson Prize from your publisher, Black Lawrence.
It did indeed.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
These characters in your stories are often just normal people who come across some kind of extraordinary circumstance, and one of my favorite examples of this is in the story Lonesome Road. That's the story where I'll just briefly summarize for our listeners. Shelley, she loses her son in the war, and she loses her husband because her husband can't stand her grief. So she moves in with her mother, and across the street there's this guy named Rick, and he's got an old Victrola who can allow you to listen to the dead calling out to the living. Fascinating story from beginning to end. Tell me, what was your inspiration for this one?
I think it goes back to my fascination with recorded music. One of the things I noticed putting the book together is there are a lot of record players and Victrolas in it, which is not by design at all. It's just something that's always interested me. I like really old American music, early recordings, and it feels like listening to the voices of the past. And I was thinking about some of my friends who I had grown up with, gone to elementary school with, who didn't make it through the Iraq War, or who were wounded in the Iraq War. And I was thinking about their parents, you know, because these were people of my parents' age, and wondered how they carried on, because it seems to me one of the really great losses in life is losing a child. Children should outlive their parents. And I don't know how people carry that weight and that burden. And so when I don't know something, particularly something emotional, I try to work it out through fiction. And this was one way to do that. And instead of just writing a straightforward story about grief, I came back to the questions of recorded voices. What are these voices? And what do they do to us? And what would it be to really, really want to hear a voice you had lost and to be given the opportunity to do so? Would you take that opportunity?
Mm. Some of your stories occur in sort of the shadow of some kind of apocalypse or a world where the world that we know doesn't exist anymore, and there's a new arrangement, a new social arrangement, a new governmental arrangement. And I wanted to ask you, what appeals to you about this kind of fiction?
I think the idea of your world suddenly changing, and one day everything is normal and the next day everything is different, is both a terror I sort of have. We've all experienced it at moments of heightened emotion. If somebody close to you dies or something, you lose your job or something like that, your world changes very, very suddenly. It's not what it was the day before. And I'm always drawn to that kind of emotion, that way of thinking through a story, because it gives a story a kind of propulsion. I'm also always sort of worried about the future. I think that if you worry about the future a lot, then apocalyptic scenarios are really appealing to you.
This kind of fiction has such a strong sense of character. And the kind of things that we've just been talking about seem to be the kind of things that appear in science fiction. One of the most common critiques of science fiction as a genre is that it's not very strong in character development. It's often written for folks who just really like to see the technology, you know, and that's totally fine. But would you call this book, Blood, science fiction?
Some of the stories in it are aspiring science fiction. I've been a science fiction reader most of my life, so I have a great sense of what science fiction is and can do and really respect that. And I think I'm generally not much of a science fiction writer. Even the story that's most science fictional expositions, by the end, sort of falls apart in its science fictionality, because a lot of science fiction is about a particular ideas and speculations about technology, and I'm not really all that interested in speculations about technology. I like other people's, but I don't feel like that's where my brain goes. So I probably draw on the motifs and themes of science fiction a lot simply because I've read tons and tons and tons of it, but it's not where my mind as a fiction writer necessarily goes. That said, there are all sorts of different types of science fiction out there. And one of the things as a kid that I used to do is get into arguments with an English teacher at Plymouth State who declared to me that science fiction was formula fiction. And this was the thing I most deeply loved in the world. I was a subscriber to Isaac Asimov's magazine and all sorts of things. I was just reading it all the time and just loved it. And I wanted everybody else to love it too. And he didn't. And he frowned on it. And so I spent a lot of time thinking through, how can I prove to somebody that science fiction actually has merit? And that's affected actually a lot of my life since then. I became very interested in the work of Samuel R. Delaney, who's a science fiction writer but also a literary theorist. And I did my master's degree on him. He's part of my PhD dissertation. And so that whole question back to when I was, I think, 12 years old of does science fiction have literary merit? Is it formula fiction? Has haunted me for my whole life. And it's still something I'm always thinking about because it goes back to the question of what is fiction? What can it be? What should it do? And those are the kinds of questions that not only fuel me as an intellectual, but also as a writer. Because as a writer, you're trying to create forms and shapes that can do new things in your reader's mind.
So what should fiction do?
That's a great question. I'm always asking myself that. I think that fiction should give us new ways of experiencing our lives. It puts something into our minds. It gives us imagined scenarios. It lets us see our way through a world that we didn't otherwise know. And so as a fiction writer, we have this ability to create these worlds through language. And so I think that the responsibility we have as fiction writers is both to the worlds and to the language, ideally. I'm sort of speaking utopianly here. What we all aim for is taking these worlds created out of language and putting them in some way in other people's minds to see what will happen.
This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking with Matthew Cheney. He's the author of the new collection of short stories, Blood. Sounds like you've wanted to be a writer for a very long time, especially if you're discussing the art of fiction as a 12-year-old with a university professor.
Yes, I was a weird, geeky little kid. It was lucky I lived in a university town, and my mother worked at the college.
You grew up in Plymouth.
I did. I've lived in Plymouth for all but a few years of my life. And so, yes, I was the Lamson Library at Plymouth State College, now Plymouth State University, was really where I learned to read. And so it was something I wanted to do from very early on. First, I wanted to be an FBI agent. Then I think I wanted to be a painter. And then I wanted to be a writer and pretty much stuck with that.
So pretty much you went through the same transition that all children go through.
Yes, in some way or
From
another.
From the FBI to a painter to a writer,
of course. What I liked about the FBI is they carry a briefcase. I really wanted to carry a briefcase.
What's stopping you now?
Well, nothing. You know, writers get to carry briefcases too. And once I figured that out, it was much easier.
Where do you find your inspiration these days?
I think that I find inspiration both from reading other people's writing and from looking out at the world. It's very easy, especially if you're a writer like me who's read so much and thought so much about texts, it's very easy to get stuck inside of the words. And so I do my best to look out at the world and see what's happening and stay friends with people who are not writers or academics or things like that. So, and always challenging myself then to think about not just what do I want to write, but what do I want to write and then give someone to read, because I think that's a different responsibility. I do like to write for myself, but then I'm taking this stuff and asking people to publish it, having it come out in a book, asking people to pay money for it. So if you're going to do that, you have to think about what do you feel is worth other people's time.
And I imagine if you follow the news, you'll find no shortage of things that would inspire the kind of apocalyptic fiction that you've been writing.
Yes, it's terrifying. I've actually pulled back on my news consumption these days because it can just you can reach a point of hopelessness if you really start thinking about all of the challenges of the world.
You feel like you've almost reached that point?
Oh, no. No, I push against it as much as I can. Because also, I read a lot of history and study a lot of history. And one of the things is that the world is always ending. The world has always been ending. I think people always felt like they were on the precipice of apocalypse throughout history. And so I take a little bit of comfort from that, is that we're not the first people who thought that we were the last people.
And I hear you grew up in a gun shop in New Hampshire.
I did indeed. Quite literally, the shop was attached to the house that I grew up in. And so my father was a sort of stay-at-home work dad. And so when I was a little kid, he would, you know, be working in the shop and then come take care of me. And he did that for about 40 years until his death. And I never paid a lot of attention to it growing up. It just was there. It wasn't something that really interested me. And so when he died suddenly and I'm an only son, my parents are divorced, I inherited a gun shop about which I knew almost nothing. So I had to learn a lot about the gun industry. It took about 2 years to sell it all off.
Well, you must have learned something about the guns, because, I mean, they appear in the story. In fact, there's one story in here where there's a father who is a gun repairman, and he goes kind of crazy. I hope that didn't happen in your family, but
no, it didn't.
Okay, but yes. he goes crazy and sort of starts thinking that the government's out to get him, and many shots were fired in the story. I don't want to give it away, but seems like you found some inspiration in that.
Yes, the title story of the book Blood is all about a very heightened sort of version of my growing up. I'm an only child. There are like four or five children in that family. It's a very different circumstance, but the sense of paranoia that comes with it, living in a gun shop, will breed a great amount of paranoia in you.
Really?
Yeah, I remember telling babysitters when they would come, the first thing I would do if they were new was show them where you could hide in the house without being seen through any of the windows.
Huh.
Just because, and I just inherited this paranoia that comes with that kind of business when it's attached to your house. And I think that the title story is really an attempt to write through that and write out of that and find a way through it.
Do you own a gun now?
I don't. I got rid of all of them, except for I have an old Civil War rifle that's about 7 feet long, and you would never want to shoot it because it might blow up.
Okay. Well, Matthew Cheney, thank you very much for coming in and talking about your collection of stories.
Great. Thank you so much.
Peter Biello there speaking with Matthew Cheney, whose debut collection of stories is called Blood. You can hear episodes from The Bookshelf each Friday on All Things Considered. We play them every other week here on Word of Mouth. And if you enjoy hearing about the creative minds behind the written word, you can download The Bookshelf podcast and our 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen. And a special shout out today to all of you who had the courage to put yourself out there and submitted a book pitch. The deadline was today, and we did send them off with great hope to the agent at Zachary Schuster Harmsworth, who's going to have a look at them. She'll be joining us with some feedback and tips for submitting a winning book pitch. That'll be on our upcoming book show. That's in the future, but for today, we've run out of time. More stories at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to share the show with others and offer your own feedback through our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too with more Word of Mouth from NHPR.